The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Miku, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this hour. Before we begin our conversation with Dr. Stephen Thomas about nuclear power and the battle around the world and this country and in Maryland specifically, I want to take just a moment to remember what today is, which is the anniversary of the birth of Malcolm X, who was born Malcolm Little in Omaha, Nebraska, in 1925, and one of the most important Americans in modern history. What he's done for us all, and I remember as a very young man of 19 years old when Malcolm X was assassinated. I was here in Baltimore and then jumped a bus and took it to New York to stand in line as his body lay in state to view the body and pay our respects after he was assassinated. And it was a time of assassinations, and he really entered American politics, the American realm, talking about race in a way that few have. And he's had a very powerful influence on this country and many of our thinkings and thoughts and ways we think. And so we want to play just for a moment an excerpt from an interview that Malcolm X gave when he returned to America from his Hajj to Mecca that changed his life considerably. This was after he was leaving and thrown out of the Nation of Islam. He gave this interview on May 21st, 1964. And in this interview, Malcolm X explains that he's not a racist. He doesn't subscribe to any of the tenets of racism, that he judges people based on their actions. And this is something for us to think about and reflect on as we think about today as the birthday of Malcolm X.
And this is what I had to become aware of on my pilgrimage to Mecca. I could see then that there are many white people in this country who will side with the Negro in whatever he has to do to protect himself.
But that's a considerable change of opinion in Malcolm X.
No, today I'm speaking for myself. Formerly, I spoke for Elijah Muhammad, and everything I said was, Elijah Muhammad teaches us thus and so. I'm speaking now from what I think, from what I have seen, from what I have analyzed, and the conclusions that I have reached.
Then the white man is no longer the devil, and he is no longer bound to be evil?
If I judge a man by his conscious behavior, I am not a racist. I don't subscribe to any of the tenets of racism.
Then there are good whites and good blacks. And bad whites and blacks.
It's not a case of being good and bad, good or bad blacks and whites. It's a case of being good or bad human beings.
Which is a piece of an interview that Malcolm X did in 1964, and we've done many shows about Malcolm X's thoughts and his life and career. We'll come back to that on another day, but we want to pay our respects today on this anniversary of Malcolm X's birth. It's May 19th. He was born in Omaha, Nebraska in 1925. And now we're going to switch to another controversy facing our society, as that was a controversy facing America back in the mid-60s. Right now, the question of what our energy future should be is a huge controversy. One of the things we've had on the show many times are debates about the future of nuclear power in our country and whether it is an option for Maryland, is an option for America, is an option for the world. Is it a lot of hype? We've heard a great deal about plants being built. 34 licenses are up for renewal here in the United States of America. I mean, for building plants in the United States of America. There's a battle here in Maryland over building another plant in Calvert Cliffs. We are joined this hour by Dr. Stephen Thomas, who's professor of energy studies at the University of Greenwich in London. He's been a researcher in energy policy for more than 25 years. And he'll be speaking, by the way, this evening after our program at 7 p.m. In the Peabody Room of the Cathedral of Incarnation at the corner of Charles University Parkway, which is the right there at Fort East University Parkway, and to talk about these issues we're talking about tonight. You can meet him personally there and have this conversation. But right now he joins us here in the studio. The lines are open at 410-319-8888. And Dr. Thomas, good to have you in the studio.
Thank you.
So let's talk about the things you've been writing and where we are with the battle over nuclear energy. I mean, we have now in a position where everybody is trying to figure out a way to not rely on a fossil fuel-based economy. And a lot of environmentalists, a lot of environmental leaders, a lot of people in the environmental movement have come to their realization, they think, that the nuclear option is one that we have to follow, that it is the only sure way of producing energy that does not pollute the earth?
Well, I think if you go back to the 1990s, the belief then was that you could leave it all to markets, that if we opened the energy sector up to the markets, then you would get the ideal solution. And that proved to be a very short-term solution. And now it's clear that we're going to have to spend money to get to where we need to in terms of environmental solutions. We need to put public money in to make sure that the electricity system is clean enough. And I think what my concern is to make sure that we are costing nuclear correctly, so that when we make a choice between nuclear and renewables or energy efficiency or whatever other options, we know exactly what the cost is, so that we can use our public money as wisely as possible.
Well, let's talk. I'm going to get to the cost and the problem of financing that you've been writing about recently. We're going to talk about Calvert Cliffs. But when you look at the worldwide debate over the future of energy and power for different nations, you look in your own continent, in the European Union, you look at Sweden and France, where the majority of their energy comes from nuclear power. And some people are arguing that they are way ahead of the curve, that they are developing safe technology. Safe atomic technology they are providing. They look at Sweden. Sweden's probably one of the cleanest environments in the world because it's either hydroelectric power or it's nuclear power. So people make a very strong argument in Western Europe that this is the way we have to proceed, that technology exists, that the technology for renewables is an unknown quantity. It may work well on some small scales, but on large scale, no one has proven it can work. And that we really that looking at the French and Swedish model, that there are very few options other than that.
Well, I think if you look at Europe, you can see that what nuclear capacity exists in Europe was mostly built a long time ago. And Sweden completed its last plant more than 20 years ago. It has a decision now taken by the people to phase out nuclear power. And I think that decision is going to be very difficult to reverse. I mean, if we're looking at actually doing something significant to reduce the scale of greenhouse gas emissions, then I think we have to look at what scale of nuclear power programs you would need. And getting 20% of your electricity from nuclear power, which is a typical percentage in Europe, it's more in France, more in Sweden, but that's about typical for most of the countries, is really not going to do much for global warming. You're going to reduce emissions if you increased it, say, to 40% by 4 or 5%. If you really wanted to do something serious about global warming with nuclear power, then you have to, your electricity system has to be dominated by nuclear power. Not only that, but electricity has to come in and substitute for a lot of other direct uses of fossil fuels. And then you have to think, well, how many reactors is that going to take? Where are we going to put them? And questions that have really not been thought of for the last 20 or 30 years, like is there enough uranium to provide that nuclear power, start to become important.
Is there?
Well, using the technologies that we use at present, probably not. There are technologies that use uranium much more sparingly, but those bring with them a lot of baggage. I mean, to be more explicit, The way to use uranium very efficiently is to use fast reactors and to separate plutonium. And then you have large amounts of separated plutonium being transported around the globe, and that's a very, very large proliferation risk. So from that point of view, then you need to think carefully about that, and also the history of fast reactors, that the reactors that could use uranium very efficiently is very poor. They've never been reliable. They've been very expensive to build. So, you know, if you really wanted to make a difference with nuclear power, then you have to think beyond the set of technologies that we've got now and a long way beyond the scale that we're using it on now.
When you said Sweden is phasing it out, talk a bit about what's going on in Sweden. I mean, this is often held up by many who are proponents of nuclear power and building more plants here in the United States of America and around the world, China, India, and the like. That the Swedes are the model. This is the one nation that has many argue the cleanest environment because of an energy environment in the world, and in large part because of nuclear. Talk a bit about the debate there and what happened that caused this phasing out you're talking about.
Well, the debate goes back to just after Three Mile Island, when there was a referendum on whether further nuclear power plants should be built in Sweden. The decision was quite a complex one, but in summary it said we'll complete the ones that we've got on in the way and then no more, and they will reach a certain age and then they will be closed down and not replaced. That decision always seemed to me quite difficult to put into practice, in the sense that closing down a nuclear power plant, there is always a temptation to keep it running. And that's really what's proved to be the case in Sweden, that the plants that are there continue in service. Only two of the 12 plants in service in 1987 have now been closed down, and they're quite small. So essentially, it's the situation hasn't changed very much, but to reverse that situation and start to replace them with new ones and build even more nuclear power plants, I think would be a very difficult political step and a very expensive step.
So what replaces power, let's say, in a place that has relied on nuclear power as Sweden has?
Well, the problem with the replacements is that you can't generalize in the way that you can with nuclear power. A nuclear power station is pretty much the same whether it's in Sweden or Maryland or United Kingdom, whereas every country, every region has its own set of resources, its own particular situation. So Britain, for example, has a lot of wind energy. We have the best wind resource almost in the world. We're shamefully underusing it. We also, shamefully enough, have a very poor housing stock, and it would be an extremely cost-effective thing to do to put money into improving that housing stock, because it would not only reduce our consumption, it would also benefit public welfare, because people would be more comfortable and they would be spending less money on their energy. So it would be, in the horrible cliche, a win-win situation.
But I wonder what all that, I mean, I'm very curious, before we talk about kind of the nuances of where you think the battle is over nuclear power today in America and in the world. I've read some arguments that there really is no way out of this, that given the lifestyle of the West, given the lifestyle of the United States of America, given the burgeoning lifestyles of India and China and other developing countries that want as much meat and as many cars as we have and live the same lifestyle that we have been flaunting to the world and to ourselves, that there really is no way to kind of to muddle our way out of this mess, because unless we change the way we live.
Well, I can't answer that, but I mean, I think you did raise a very important point about transport, because transport is probably more important in terms of greenhouse gas emissions than electricity generation. And in many countries, electricity generation is not growing at any very rapid pace, whereas transport demands are. Now, nuclear power is irrelevant pretty much to transport, unless you believe that you can have fleets of battery-driven cars fueled by nuclear power, which is a long, long way off and would require...
Are there people arguing for that?
I haven't heard a serious argument for that. But, you know, you need to deal with the transport problem, and, of course, that's politically much hotter issue than dealing with power generation, which is one step removed from the final consumer. The final consumer just sees electricity. They want to know, is it reliable and what's the cost of it? If you're dealing with transport, then you're dealing with directly with lifestyle issues. You're telling them you need to think about using public transport rather than your own private car, and you need to start thinking about whether those journeys are actually necessary or whether you can undertake them in a more efficient way.
So when you started your research 25 years ago and looking at nuclear energy and forms of energy, I'm curious where you started from and where you are now in terms of your thoughts on what has to be done to get out of our fossil fuel disaster. And I wonder, did you start at that place?
Well, when I started, nuclear was already in a decline. The Three Mile Island accident had just happened, but already the cost of nuclear power was beginning to put a dampener on the rate of expansion. there has always been arguments for nuclear power. In the 80s, it was acid gas emissions, it was dependence on unstable regimes for oil and so on. So the arguments have varied, but there have always been arguments for nuclear power. Those arguments change through time, and the latest challenge of global warming seems the most intractable of them all, because there is no easy way out for it.
We're talking with Dr. Stephen Thomas, who's Professor of Energy Studies at the University of Greenwich in London. He's been studying energy policy for the last 25 years. He's here in the United States talking, and he is meeting with groups. He's talking tonight about the nuclear option for Maryland in a panel discussion. It'll be held at 7 p.m. tonight at the Cathedral of the Incarnation, at 4 East University Parkway, at Charles University Parkway. You can join him there after our program and join in on that conversation. Let's talk a bit about the state of Maryland here. I understand that you, despite living in London and teaching at the University of Greenwich, that this is something you know a great deal about. The Maryland Public Service Commission has issued a state construction permit to build a new plant in Calvert Cliffs, where the other two plants are. Mm-hmm. And the mayor, our governor, pardon me, Martin O'Malley, has made saying that it would be irresponsible and immoral for us not to build this plant if we are going to tackle our energy future. And so tell us what you know, first of all, about Unistar and Electricité de France and Constellation Energy and the relationship they have there.
Electricité de France is the state-controlled electric utility for France. In Europe, all the European countries must, by European Union law, open up their markets to competition. So in theory, EDF is not a monopoly in France, but in practice it has 90% of the generation and 90% of the consumers buy their electricity from Electricité de France. They were 100% state-owned until 3 or 4 years ago, when the state sold off about 15% of their stock. So they are very closely identified with the French government. And also, if you look at the other important player as far as Maryland goes, it's Areva, which is the French nuclear power vendor, the company that sells the nuclear power plants. And that's over 90% owned by the French taxpayer. So you've got to see it very much, nuclear power, as very much a French government policy. They have they own the electric utility, they own the vendor, and they're prepared to put big money into supporting that industry through export credit guarantees for exports of plants from the French company.
So how does that affect us? What does it mean for Maryland?
Well, it means that you have two very powerful companies, which on the face of it sounds a very good thing. If you, you know, if your investment is backed by the French government, then that sounds like a pretty deep pocket underlying any investment. I think the changes in Electricité de France and Areva in the past few years mean that there is some distance now between the French government and those two companies. And I wouldn't rely so much on the French government absolutely backing every investment EDF made. EDF in the past has always been able to invest in foreign countries using the funds it was putting aside to decommission the 58 nuclear power plants it had. That was not a sensible way to be going on, because some of their investments were poor and the money was lost. From the past 3 or 4 years onwards, they no longer have access to that pot of money, and they now have, for the first time, when they're going outside France, to borrow money. So to buy into Constellation, the Maryland utility, and to buy into British Energy, the big British company that they took over earlier this year, they've had to borrow money and create special companies, wholly owned subsidiaries, to carry out that expansion. So you need to start asking questions about what the lines are between those companies and EDF. Can EDF walk away from it if this vehicle that they've created to buy Constellation goes wrong.
Can they?
Well, looking at the experience of EDF, they have always been a little bit schizophrenic in terms of how they operate in France and how they operate outside France. In France, they are very much the government-controlled company operating in a very ethical and a very socially conscious way. They took over utilities in Brazil and Buenos Aires, walked in and sacked half the working force straight away. So, in a way that would never have been acceptable in France. So, you know, there is distance between the way they operate outside France and the way they operate in France. So, if things did go horribly wrong, and things do go horribly wrong with nuclear power projects, then I would not rely on the French government riding to the rescue.
Folks, you can join us here at 410-319-8888. We're talking with Dr. Stephen Thomas, Professor of Energy Studies at the University of Greenwich in London. We know that there is a big argument taking place in our state here, whether or not to build nuclear power plants. Another one is online. Well, not online so much as being its construction permit has been allowed. It has a great deal more to go through before it can be allowed to be built. And it's a debate that we should have with ourselves about where we want to invest our money and how that should happen. And I'd like to hear your thoughts. 410-319-8888 or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com as we talk with Dr. Stephen Thomas. And you can join in on this conversation whenever you'd like. And many of you I know have called in before. Some of you work in that industry, have your thoughts on that, and we'd love to hear your thoughts on that right now. 410-319-8888. So right now the Maryland Public Service Commission is reviewing the deal between the French group, the EDF, and the Constellation, and EDF would then acquire half of Constellation, which would their nuclear fleet, and would change the kind of would change a great deal. I wonder, I mean, when you've seen these struggles take place in other places, there's a lot of power here, no pun intended, but a lot of power here with Constellation Energy and the forces and the money behind it. Mm. It seems almost in some ways, given the fear and panic in America about the future of energy, a hard thing to stop.
Well, the policy of EDF has changed rather in the last 2 or 3 years. That in the past, up till then, they'd been investing in the markets around France, and they'd been operating very much as electricity companies. So they have a strong position in Britain, France, Germany, Belgium, and so on. In the last 2 or 3 years, they've started to invest in nuclear capabilities some distance from France. So UK, they have bought the British nuclear company for about $18 billion. So they've big investment there. They've also bought into China about $3 or $4 billion there, and they've made the investment with Baltimore.
So then when you talk about it in the UK, in your own home, in the United Kingdom, so England has nuclear capacity for energy. Isn't there a battle going on in Britain about building? And you just said about building new plants?
Yeah, I mean, Britain was one of the first countries with nuclear power, and our fleet of nuclear power plants is getting old. It never was very good, to be brutally honest. It's been the most unreliable in the West, to put it more directly. That fleet of plants is getting near the end of its life. It contributes about 20% of the electricity generation in Britain, so not a huge percentage and not, frankly, very difficult to replace. But in 3 years ago, the government, which had previously, only 3 years before, had said that nuclear was economically unattractive compared to renewables and to energy efficiency, and that there were issues about waste disposal that needed to be resolved before a nuclear expansion could be contemplated, suddenly reversed that position for no well-documented reason and decided that we would go forward with nuclear power. And Tony Blair's words were, "Nuclear power is back with a vengeance." That process, like the process in the United States, has gone very slowly, partly because all the designs that are being looked at are untested. We have in the United States, they're looking at 5 designs. There's a little bit of experience in Japan with one of them. But of the other 4, and the one that is being proposed for Maryland, the only experience we have is 4 years of construction in Finland and 2 years of construction in France. So these are new designs that are untested, that have not gone through the regulatory process of checking whether they are safe or not. And we're still 3 or 4 years away from completing that process in Britain. Then we have to find sites and get approval for those sites. So in Britain, despite Tony Blair making this very strong statement that nuclear power was back with a vengeance in 2006, we're probably still 4 or 5 years away from being in a position to order a new nuclear power plant.
But if the plants themselves, if the power is not back with a vengeance, the power of the nuclear industry is back with a vengeance. I mean,
this is one of the bewildering things for me. When I started this business 30 years ago, I could see what the nuclear lobby was. There were state-owned research laboratories which had the highest access to government. There were equipment supply companies. There was a company called GEC, which was going to supply the pressurized water reactors. There were companies that were going to supply the pumps. The research laboratories are essentially closed now. The companies have long since gone out of business. So I don't really understand where this pressure for nuclear power comes from. And it's a phenomenon that we find everywhere, that there is a peculiar charm about nuclear power that seems to captivate people like Tony Blair and now Gordon Brown, George Bush. They seem to have a particular evangelical zeal, if you like, about nuclear power as the only possible way to solve problems.
Well, I have other questions about that, and we'll push it further when we come back from this break. We're talking with Stephen Thomas, Dr. Stephen Thomas, Professor of Energy Studies at the University of Greenwich in London. He is joining us now for the next half an hour. He is going to be speaking tonight on the nuclear option for Maryland, how the global nuclear experience applies to the local. And it'll be tonight at the Peabody Room at the Cathedral of Incarnation at 4 East University Parkway. It starts at 7 o'clock tonight, and you can join him there. And you can join us now at 410-319-8888. And you can stay tuned. We'll be right back with more of this conversation. I want to remind you, before we go to break, that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression. And over 70 years later, they're still there to help people during difficult times. More information is available at mecu.org. And I also want, before we go to break, remind you all that to join us live next Wednesday on May the 27th, a very special event. We have a live broadcast of this show, The Mark Steiner Show, from the Murphy Fine Arts Center at Morgan State University. We'll be interviewing Bob Luke, author of the new book from Johns Hopkins Press, The Baltimore Elite Giants, which is one of the great teams of the Negro Baseball Leagues back in the 40s. And he'll be joined on stage by Bert Simmons, who is a pitcher on that team. And it's a live broadcast from here, followed by a book signing and reception. You can join us for that and go to steinershow.org or call 410-516-4162 to get information and join us there. It's free and open to the public. We'll be right back with Dr. Stephen Thomas in just a minute. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Stephen Thomas, Professor of Energy Studies at the University of Greenwich in London, who is here on a tour to talk about nuclear energy, and will be speaking tonight at the Cathedral of the Incarnation at 4 East University Parkway at 7 p.m. this evening. Before we jump back into the conversation, I'll remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. And you can join us here at 410-319-8888 or write to us at Steiner Show mcmanus@gmail.com to join in on this conversation. We were talking to, just before I went to break and during the break, about why this has taken hold and the kind of, clearly, I mean, there's a, there's a political move afoot at the highest levels to bring nuclear power back with a rage in America. There are, like, if I remember reading what I read earlier, to my, that there are 34 plants that are applying for construction around the country, all the way from Texas on up. And 21 companies are seeking permission. The largest builder of nuclear reactors, we talked before, Areva and Northrop Grumman, have invested $360 million in a shipyard in Newport News to build components for the 7 proposed reactors, and even more for export. And it's, I mean, it's a there's a lot of investment here. A lot of people are invested in making this happen.
Well, I think if you look at the companies involved, I think you have to be divide them into two. I think you look at the electric utilities, and I think they have one set of agendas, and then you look at the supply companies who have a different agenda. The electric utilities, I think what they see with the nuclear power program that President Bush set in place was government subsidies and insulation from the market. They thought that they could push the government and get large subsidies, which would make nuclear power profitable to them. And I think the and you need to start to think, well, who is going to pay for those costs? And if you look at the subsidies, then cutting to the chase, it's very much the taxpayer. In terms of the other end of it, who stands to benefit, then it's not so clear to me. The big American companies that have supplied nuclear power, the existing nuclear power plants, the four big companies, General Electric, Westinghouse, Babcock and Wilcox, and Combustion Engineering. Well, Westinghouse is now owned by Toshiba, the Japanese company. General Electric has won about one order in the past 30 years. Babcock and Wilcox is long out of the game after the Three Mile Island accident, and Combustion Engineering has been out of it for a long time. So it's not the obvious players that are pushing it. Maybe if you scratch down another layer and find the equipment suppliers beneath them, the pump suppliers, maybe the concrete and steel people, maybe you will find a constituency. But it's not as clear-cut as that, I don't think.
Well, if, in, let's say, in Great Britain, where you come from, where you live, where you said earlier in the program that wind, that Britain is probably the prime location on the planet to create wind power and to become perhaps self-sufficient in energy via wind and their own oil that they have as well, that can't get any traction. Yet this is part of the argument.
Mm.
And it seems like wherever you go, that renewables cannot get traction in an argument about the future. Is that because it's just too pie in the sky, and there's been a history of nuclear power, and it's here, and people know it?
I think if you look at the 2006 statement, that was the fifth time that the British government has tried to relaunch the nuclear power program in Britain, going back to 1965. And what have we got out of it? We've got a selection of pretty unreliable plants, as I said earlier, which is bad enough. But the real issue, I think, is the what you might call the opportunity cost. What have we not done because we thought we were going to get a lot of power from nuclear power stations? We have these unused resource of renewables. We have a housing stock that's shamefully poor by Western standards, all because the government sees that nuclear power has done the job, moves on to the next issue. Nuclear power is easy. You say, here's a nuclear power program, off you go, job done. Mm-hmm. We'll move on to the health question now, or education. If you want a renewables program or you want an energy efficiency program, government has to keep paying attention and keep looking and keep managing it, and it doesn't want to do that.
We're talking about nuclear power, the debate going on here in Maryland and around the world about is this the way for our energy future? Dr. Stephen Thomas is with us, professor of energy from Greenwich, University of Greenwich in London. 410-319-8888. What do you think about our energy future? Which way should we go? How should we get there? And what are you thinking about it when it comes to these issues? 410-319-8888. And Pete in Colombia, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. I'm wondering whether many Marylanders are aware of the subsidy to nuclear power that comes from the Price-Anderson Act that insulates the owners from most of the liability if there's a serious contamination incident. It was enacted many decades ago when the industry was in its infancy, and I believe the Congress was told that it was just a startup thing and wouldn't have to be reenacted, and yet it has been every decade or so. Is this subsidy widely known?
No, it's not widely known, I don't think. Do you know about the subsidy, even?
Yes, I mean, all the countries in the world work on the basis of signing up to various international conventions. There's the Brussels Convention, there's the Vienna Convention. But what all these conventions essentially do is to limit the liability of the owners of nuclear power plants in the event of an accident. And they limit that liability to a very small amount of money. And typically you're talking about $200 or $300 million, which might sound a lot of money, but when you think that a nuclear power plant is expected to cost $10 billion, and when you think of the damage from the Chernobyl disaster running into hundreds of billions of dollars, then that's a very important facilitating act. In other words, without it, nuclear power would not be possible, because nobody would build a nuclear power plant if they were potentially subject to paying damages of hundreds of billions of dollars. And of course, the world insurance market would find it very difficult to absorb that. You know, you could take out a policy with an insurance company, but what insurance company is going to meet a claim for a couple of $100 billion? I mean, I think it's, even if you took out the policy, it would lack credibility.
But that, what he's saying, what Peter's saying, this Price-Anderson Act is one of the reasons that I think that the industry is so fueled in its argument, no pun intended again, because they're protected. And there's a lot of money in building plants. It's a huge amount of money in building plants. Hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars are involved here.
Well, I think if you look at the history of nuclear power in the United States and elsewhere, it's only been possible because of the way in which risk was apportioned. Nuclear power has always been seen as an economically very risky venture. And the plants in America were built on the basis that if anything went wrong, consumers always paid. So if it cost more to build than you expected, and that was almost universally the situation with nuclear power plants in America, the electricity company just put up the rates. And in some cases, there was what was called rate shock, which meant that electricity prices went up by a factor of 3 or 4 as a nuclear power plant came into service. Now, that, again, was also an unseen subsidy to nuclear power, because the company building the plant were not exposed to the economic risk that was associated with it.
Pete, thanks so much for that call. I'm glad you raised that issue. It's one I think most people don't know about, and I'm glad you brought the issue to the table. 410-319-8888, and Oscar in Chestnut Ridge, you're on the air.
Right. Well, as an environmentalist, I looked at the options back in the 70s and knew that we had two choices for centralized power. One was fossil fuels, mainly coal, and the other was nuclear. And I had to make the judgment which way to go, and I decided on nuclear because it was performing well and because nuclear waste was containable, whereas fossil fuels was by definition going to foul the atmosphere and lead to global change, and it has. And if you go to Calvert Cliffs, which I have, and you stand on the overlook, right, looking out on the plant, a comment made to me by a visitor standing there was, "Is the thing on?" I said, "Sure, it's on. It's supplying all the power of metropolitan Baltimore City right now." And they said, "Well, it's nothing happening. There's nothing coming out of it. There's no steam. There's no clouds. There's no pollution. There's nothing coming out. I can't even hear it running. How do you know it's on?" So if you look at it, And you look at it from what the alternatives are today, like solar, which is real sexy but not really dependable. You look at solar as far as electric generation is concerned, and to have the power plants of solar equal to one of the plants at Calvert Cliffs, which is one of two, you'll need 234 square miles of solar panels. And that just can't be done. So, you know, realistically, we've operated pretty well with Baltimore Gas and Electric and Constellation down at Calvert Cliffs. Their plants have run in as the standard for the industry in the United States. I think they can run it. I think they'll do well with the next plant. And when we're going to have 20 or 30% increase in demand in the next 15, 20 years, we got to meet it somehow. And this is one way to meet it.
Austin, you make a strong argument. Stephen Thomas?
Well, I think on the issue of nuclear cost, you have to... Times have changed since Calvert Cliffs was built. I mean, you would expect with any technology, any normal technology, you expect things like learning, economies of scale, and so on. All the things that seem to work with, say, a motor car. If you look at cars now, they perform 10 times as well as they did 30 years ago, and the real cost has gone down. That's never happened with nuclear power. Nuclear power has always gone up in real terms. So the plants that we're building now, or we would be building now, are way more expensive than the ones 50 years ago in real terms. And what's particularly striking is how costs have changed in the past 7 or 8 years since President Bush announced his nuclear 2010 program. When that was announced, the nuclear industry was saying very confidently that you could build a large nuclear power plant for less than $2 billion. If you look now at the cost estimates, they're now in the region of $10 billion and still rising. So, you know, when a technology breaks all the rules of technology developing in the way nuclear is doing, then you have to ask, is there something underneath that we should be thinking about? Is there something more fundamentally wrong with the nuclear power technology? Because, you know, costs should have gone down. I mean, the French built 58 nuclear power plants and in a period of about 15 years. Now, that should have been the absolute hothouse of learning how to do it well. And if you look at their costs, EDF's figures, Electricité de France's own figures, tell you that the last plant they built was 25% more expensive in real terms than the first one. So what's going on there? You know, if any normal technology should be getting cheaper and we should be getting better at it. But actually the last plant was pretty unreliable and it was pretty expensive.
Well, I want to go to another call. Oscar, thanks for the call. I'm going to go to the next caller, but I want to pick up what Oscar said, which was, then what is the alternative? I mean, but 410-319-8888, Pat in Catonsville, you're on the air.
I wanted to ask about a report in the New York Times about Indian Point, just north of Manhattan. They found a leak in the pipes underneath the plant. Now, this is a matter of infrastructure, and we have a lot of mechanical works in other parts of the nuclear plant, but underneath, no one had taken a look there, or did they feel they had to. And yet, it was leaking. It wasn't leaking anything dangerous, I want to say, but it poses a problem when we have renewal of licenses for so many plants across the country. And it would be good to know what they plan to do about such things. We can't take care of our water infrastructure, much less the nuclear infrastructure.
What about the infrastructure of nuclear plants and the safety issue?
Well, I think the issue of life extension is a very important one, and I'm not technically qualified to say whether it's feasible. The nuclear power plants that we have now were given a design life of 35 to 40 years. They're now being extended to 60 years. And I have to accept the judgment of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission if they believe that is so. But you know, you're looking at plants that were designed in the 70s before Three Mile Island and accident, certainly before Chernobyl, without those lessons in place. So you're effectively giving another 20, 30 years life to a plant that was designed before we had that experience, before we had that knowledge. So it's a very serious business, this life extension. As I say, I can't, if the NRC says it's safe, then I'm not the person to say that they are wrong, but it is a very serious decision, and I hope that it's being given the seriousness that it deserves by the NRC.
But what is the alternative? I mean, when you said that nobody's taking wind seriously in Britain, when people are not talk about the difference between a nuclear power and, let's say, wind or solar or any renewable, is that the grid exists to move the, albeit not so much efficiently all the time and a great cost to us, but that they have the grid is there to move power into electricity through the grid with that power in place. But it is not there for solar. It's not there for wind. It's not there for wave energy. We haven't kind of developed that at a point, and that renewables may sound great, some people would argue, but they really have not proven themselves to be effective, and perhaps not. Let me just leave it there.
Well, I think if you get into the mindset of saying what is the alternative to nuclear power, you get into the mindset of thinking there has to be one big answer. And there isn't one big answer. There are a lot of answers, and every place will have a different set of different blend of answers. As far as the reliability of wind goes, I think it's not right to say that it's not been proved to be reliable. If you look at Denmark, and Denmark has as reliable as an electricity system as anywhere in Europe, they're getting 20-25% of their power from wind. So I think the argument that it's not reliable, it doesn't stand up. Would I want to be 100% dependent on wind? No, I wouldn't. I would be looking at a blend of things. And I think that you can't, looking for a single answer, an alternative to nuclear power is the wrong way. And it's going to lead you into the wrong philosophy. You have to look at what you can do now, what you can do best, and move incrementally and see how the situation develops. You can't design systems for 50 or 60 years' time. We don't know what's going to be required then. So we need to do the best that we can now for the next 10 or 15 years and then move forward in that way.
So if any of these energy systems that we're talking about, and we're saying that everything, the last debates we've had on nuclear power on this show, it was clear from both sides that if we invested in that technology, if we invested in nuclear reactors, then it would take 20 years for those reactors to come online. So then, where does society invest its money? I mean, so I'm saying, you know, it's to say that nuclear power is unsafe, that there are medical dangers, as other people have pointed out, which we haven't talked about very much in the course of this hour, that there are waste issues to deal with reactors. Then where do you go? If people are serious about moving away from fossil fuels, which clearly is not going to happen for a while to come, because we're wedded to that, and our industry is wedded to that, and our homes are wedded to that, then what direction does the society go in?
Well, if you look at the scale of money that the government wants to put in, or the nuclear industry wants to be put into the nuclear power business, and they're asking for loan guarantees in the order of $120 billion, so that might be an expenditure of $60 billion. They're looking for various other subsidies and guarantees. Let's say they're worth $10 or $20 billion. So that's $80 billion that's on offer. What would happen if you put that into energy efficiency?
Now, we've heard the energy efficiency argument a great deal on this program. And many of people who are involved in the environmental movement, in public interest work, make the argument that that is where money should be invested as we're trying to figure out our way out of the fossil fuel mess. You described your own country, Britain, as being a disaster in that regard because of the housing stock. Mm. But you're saying that we've hit an argument that we could save half of our energy cost and use if we just change the energy efficiency standards and changed and moved in that direction?
I think it's what we need to be doing now. It's the best thing we can do, and when we've run out of potential, then we can think we can start doing something else. But that's the best thing we can be doing now. I think there will be renewables developing, and renewables are developing. The costs are coming down, unlike nuclear power. So things like solar are getting cheaper, are getting more reliable. So they are working in the right direction. So, you know, we need to be doing the best thing we can now and then see what options are open to us.
Now, I don't know if you're a gambling man or not, Stephen Thomas, but if you think about and if you look at the arguments taking place around the world and look at China, look at India, look at what's going on in the United States of America right now, where do you think this debate and policy will go in the next year or two when it comes to building or not building new nuclear reactors?
Well, I think there have been many second comings for nuclear power over the last 30 years. The nuclear industry has been continually saying that there was about to be a resurgence, and it's never happened. This time, what is different is that it's had the backing at the highest level, that it's not been the nuclear industry saying we need nuclear power. It's been leaders of countries. It's been George Bush. It's been Tony Blair. It's been Silvio Berlusconi. It's been at the very top. And that's a strength and a weakness. It's a strength in the sense that it makes things happen. It's a weakness that when you replace George Bush with President Obama, then maybe there is not the same push for nuclear power. Maybe when we have an election in Britain next year and Gordon Brown is not re-elected, then we'll have somebody that has a different perspective on nuclear power. So, you know, it's a strength because it'll make things happen, but it makes it very vulnerable to political changes. And before we have order plant in Britain, we'll have probably gone through two general elections.
I mean, when we were at break last time, one of the things you talked about was your own quizzicalness about the question of why so many of the leaders of the world are so enamored with nuclear power.
Mm. It's I don't want to get too political, but it is it's a sort of Iraq philosophy that it's a big problem that needs a big solution, and it's maybe as wrong-headed as the Iraq invasion was, but that's probably not. That's a comment I probably shouldn't have made.
No, you can make that comment. It's fine. I was going to.
it is that philosophy that I was talking about earlier. That if you get into this mindset, you need something big to deal with a big problem. Then you get channeled into just one particular technology. Trajectory, and you miss all the small things that you could do. All the things that, if you added them together, would make a much more coherent, much more cost-effective way of dealing with the very real problems that we have.
And it's interesting that you're here having this discussion here in Maryland, given what we are facing right here. And it is a real political battle because Constellation, the governor's office again. Martin O'Malley is in many ways staunch, is an environmentalist, pro-environmental, in many of his policies, not all. But it is a battle here and that Maryland may lose, but again, it may win. We're at a real critical point, whether or not they're going to put the money and invest to build this plant.
Well, if they do go ahead with the Calvert Cliffs plant, then I hope they do better than the Finns have done. The Finns started building their plant in 2005, and it should have come online this month.
And it's not there yet.
It's after 4 years of construction, it's still 3.5 years behind, and it's 60% over budget.
You should join tonight the Chesapeake Safe Energy Coalition, where Dr. Thomas will be this evening at the Cathedral of Incarnation at Fort East University Parkway, Charleston University Parkway, many of the groups involved in environmental issues here will be there. Join them this evening at 7 after the show is over. And Dr. Thomas, thank you so much for joining. It's been a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Stephen Thomas, Professor of Energy Studies at the University of Greenwich in London. When we return from this very brief break, we'll be joined by Glenn Greenwald, two-time New York Times bestselling author, and Michael Greenberger, who worked in the Clinton administration and the Justice Department, to look at what's going on with President Obama refusing to release photos of abusive detainees, of his support for some of the same tactics that George Bush supported when he was President of the United States of America, and find out why, and get your thoughts as well. So stay with us. We'll be right back.